Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Tech Pites. It's been a little bit since we've done one of these, but we've had a lot of great content. We've had a lot of great guests coming in, but I think this is a perfect time to just kind of look back at where we've been. Nothing big has happened since we've all been able to get in the room and talk about. Everything's the exact same, and there is nothing we all need to be dealing with. So we're going to talk about social media, and I'm really interested. No. I know, right? Yeah, there's nothing that's bad that comes from social media.
Nothing new in there either.
Exactly. It's been a great thing to add to our society as a whole. But I'm wondering for you two, as experts in your fields, as professors, as you're working with students of all different ages, where do you two find your information? How do you access it, just from your perspectives, especially within your area of content? I know we can very easily get into misinformation and all of the dark side that we tend to on this podcast go into very quickly.
We love it.
Yeah, we love that stuff. But more on the side of things, if you're trying to actually get connected with some of these people, what is that app? What is that source? Where are you getting? How do you go about that? Because that, for me, has always been what I've loved about social media, was being able to connect with people, whether it's celebrities, whether it's athletes. Yeah, you might get a like, you might get a retweet, you might get something, and you're like, oh, LeBron likes me, and now I feel better, rather than he does right now. LeBron did not retweet me. LeBron, if you want to, at the gateway, like go right ahead. Yes. But that's something that I think we might be missing, especially as misinformation, disinformation, deepfakes are coming around. Where are you all going to connect with people in your field, within your career? How are you doing that?
I'm going to let Biagio go first because he's more relatable.
I'm more modern. More modern. So this is actually a great question, and I think one of the good positive, or if it makes any sense, positive of social media is the fact that it gives access to people, to experts, and those experts contribute to the community by sharing, you know, updates in packages or like updates in new tools available. In my case, because I teach data analytic classes, I focus a lot on following the right people in that specific field. And I did that on different platform, never on Facebook. Facebook was more like just catching up with friends over time. But I quit on that because it was getting an ugly place, in my opinion.
No way.
That's just too much and waste too much time, to be honest, to reduce my productivity. But then I went to Twitter, and Twitter at the time was a great place. I think I connected with a lot of the people that actually build software, and the software I'm using R, but even Python. There is so much going on in there. And then all of a sudden, Twitter became X, and a lot of the people I was following start running away from Twitter. And so I need to find the next place where I can follow them and kind of look at their content, because their content, and actually this is like an aside comments, but it's very important. Their comment help you stay updated to what is happening in real life, especially in an ever-evolving world where like AI is taking over. There is constant release on new tools, new packages, new libraries, independently of what you're coding with. That without social media, it would be like me subscribing to each one of them individually and maybe pay so many dollars a month just to, you know, catch up. And now on social media, it's all there, available and free most of the time. So from there, I moved to LinkedIn because Mastodon wasn't really doing it for me, and for majority of those people as well, they were not creating as often content. And Discord also, I never find it an easy way to consume those type of information. So LinkedIn has been my only social media at the moment and where I get all the information.
And it again, sounds like someone who wants to be a tenure track faculty member. Like that's a very nerdy way to go about it. But I get what you're saying is like, that's where you can actually get good information.
Yeah. And actually the funny part about the comment about tenure track professor, I've seen on LinkedIn also professors, right? Sponsoring research, sponsoring ideas that they are coming up with. And some of them becoming literally influencers at this point. Like there is a famous IS professor, it's called Jason Thatcher. I think he has 100,000 followers now. And he covers all type of things by giving tips on how to find a tenure track jobs, to how to publish a high level paper in an IS journal, all those type of things. And, you know, I just follow a few of them that I know personally and a few that I know are really good. So even professor that are really good, I know personally. But I mean, it's another great way to keep up even with literature and stuff like that. So it's super fun. It will be the last place where I think professors should do what
would
doing.
You, either of you, when you started your career out, when you were going through grad school, when you're kind of working on that culmination, yeah. Would you have ever thought that your profession could have potentially had someone follow, like a following of 100,000 or above? Yeah. Like, right? I mean, I think you both have work to do, but yeah. I mean, let's get it going, guys. All right.
I mean, honestly, I think we need to invite Jason on the show. So I'm using this
episode. Go for it, Jason, if you're listening. Yes. Come on. We want to talk with you,
because I honestly don't know where he finds the time to do that and be productive as a professor. And you know, for you know, service research is just so many publications.
Maybe this is something that we need to work on. Once you're above 100,000 followers on any social media, that counts as like a class load. Yes. So you have one less
requirement.
Maybe there is something like that going on, but it's impressive. You need to have a lot of dedication in what you're doing. And of course, he took it seriously.
Well, but here's then something that I'm interested in within this one, because you have someone who's clearly an expert, as we're talking about Jason and many others in all different fields. Every field you can find someone who has 100,000 or more followers, because there's enough of those people out there that are interested in whatever profession or career that is. Is that a good thing? Like, is that something, as you two are experts in these fields, are you professors? Do you want to be at a point where someone says, literally, when you interview for your next position, or if you're going up for a promotion or to go from full, you know, any of those things, that someone says, well, what are your following? Like,
So I think you're asking if it's good. Yes. I would say, what if we ask, what are the benefits? And what is bad with it? Because ultimately, if we want to say something's good or bad, we are weighing because good versus bad, pros versus con, and then we are making a judgment. But try and make it as much objective as possible. We could agree on what's good with it, what's bad with it. I know, for example, a lot of universities, especially universities that are in the research one category, tier one category for research, one of the tenure requirements is intentionally vague, and it says you should have recognition in your field.
Right.
So the question is, can we count following of on LinkedIn by, you know, other researchers as recognition in my field? Some people would say yes. Some people would say no. Well, citations is recognition.
Right. You know? Citation is basically being, you know, added on some social media, but it's so in more of an official
way.
Are
we ready to say that following on social media, which following of social media is different from citation? When you're citing someone, you are citing something that has gone through peer review. But on social media, on LinkedIn, whatever you're posting, you have full freedom, and there's no reason, there's no accountability mechanism, just like
peer
review.
Then even your followers can be people that are completely ignorant and have no clue what you're talking about.
If the department goes out of the way and says, I'm going to look at your followers, the number of your peers, like other professors in your field that follow you, then I'm going to count that as something. Mm. But would that, that's not this. It could be in addition to looking into citations, other forms of recognition that is like has accountability in it. But LinkedIn and that kind of thing doesn't solve the social media's fundamental problem, which is lack of accountability. Everyone can say whatever they want.
Yeah.
So I want to go back. I have to correct myself. It's not 100,000. It's only 48,000. No, I'm kidding. I think that's a great question for him. I do think that. So I don't think when I started my PhD, that was even a thing. Like, you need to have followers on LinkedIn. Is any benefit of doing it? But I can see how he's bringing not only some value to his university, because he's affiliated to university and he's you know, becoming popular across the globe, but also he brings up every day many aspects of the academic life, which sometimes are not spoken of. Mm-hmm. And he brings a perspective and people comment about it. And I'm learning a lot out of it. So he brings, going back to his point of what is the value, he creates value with this. And now, of course, there is a burden that comes with it because he has probably like sometimes receive hates or sometimes negative comments and investing a
sometimes
lot of time. Yeah. I mean, yeah. And he's also investing a lot of times, which again is taking you time to do other stuff. So you need to be highly committed, and I don't think he's rewarded. So I'm not encouraging any tenure faculty to do that.
Right.
By any mean. But somebody that is established like him, mm-hmm. that has the time to do it, I think it can bring the benefits. Mm. It's just as in terms of brands,
right?
You have that many followers across the globe.
Well, and a lot of times it's maybe not even from the university, the department, wherever these professors are that have followings. A lot of times when something happens in our world, the media will look and say, this person has 48,000 mm-hmm. followers.
Yeah.
So the university might not mm-hmm. care.
Yeah,
but
the
then
public
when NBC or CNN reaches out, they're like, you have a large following, so that must be good. We're going to bring you on because we want to be able to use that.
Right.
And so now you get literally the acclaim you're looking for because a news organization put you on CNN or Fox or NBC. And now that person, that professor, gets to say, look it. I was interviewed by XYZ news organization about my research that I did.
That's recognition. Yes.
Right. But at the end of the day, when those news journalists are searching, a lot of times the first thing that pops up are the people with the most followers. So like you can kind of see where. Yeah.
I can say this, is very important. I think that's where the tricky part starts. Because there are other people in LinkedIn, for example, right now, they might have more followers than him, but they are less established in the field.
Mm.
And that they are like just using catchy phrase or tags or even making grand titles on their post that have the attention of the people. But honestly, you also like, I mean, at least as academics, you also need to prove with good publication of mm-hmm. high-level journals.
Mm-hmm.
So if that part is not there, the rigor on my side is not there. And so I'm not tend not to bite on those posts
mm-hmm.
as much as I do when I know that the person behind those posts is qualified to talk about those topics, which is very tricky because social media, as he was saying, everybody can follow you, right? It doesn't have to be a person qualified. So if those people are invited just because they have more followers than him or anybody else, he's mm-hmm. not paying me to say anything about him in this podcast, or don't have
not.
Any agreement. No, I'm just taking
just
it as an example.
We're strongly inviting Jason to come on to our
yes,
podcast.
Now he has to come. But
just send him the link.
We spent a whole podcast talking about you, Jason. Sorry.
Jokes aside, the aspect of just being popular, especially in the newer generation, as an aspect of respect or person to invite to, a TV show, radio, or whatever it is, that can be a tricky part, right? Because I can create content that calls for likes and calls from followers. I'm sorry, I can't keep cutting you off. But I think that's the double sword of that.
What I wanted to say is, so if media wants to find credible voices,
mm-hmm.
It's easy. Right. They should. It's clear where they should look. They should look at people who have recognition in the field. The question is, should they use LinkedIn as like measure of recognition again?
Yeah,
I would say so. There is, for what media is looking for, there's another aspect. One aspect is authority in the field. The other aspect, an additional aspect, is can they communicate with the public? And LinkedIn is an indication of that.
That might be what I was trying to get at. Thank you, Amin. Yes.
So if someone who's already established, not because of LinkedIn, because of their record that shows they have authority in this field and they have a good following on LinkedIn, then of course media should talk to them because they communicate well with the public. And we have had, science has had this problem for a very long time. You sometimes hear complaints that all popular science books are written by journalists that do not understand it or scientists that cannot communicate with the public. Most of the, like, if we want to communicate scientific findings and scientific advancements to the public, we have that problem. People who know what it is can't talk to the public, and people who can't talk to the public don't know what it is. So that's why when you have scientists that can communicate with people, they become world famous.
Neil deGrasse Tyson, for example.
Like in physics, we have several examples. We had, what was his name? Stephen Hawking.
Yep.
That wrote the first book was A Brief History of Time, which is like, do you look at that title? It's incredibly intriguing.
Right.
And that shows his public communication skills. So ironically, I think, yes, I think the social media can be an indication of that, but we have other means to validate someone's authority in their field as well.
So
Ross is dying over there. He's laughing at his own joke.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I actually want to say one thing, though. One aspect of social media that I think it's a positive side as well, is that, at least in the past, my impression is that media go to not only professor or expert in a field that are, you know, well known and established, but also that they represent certain schools.
Mm-hmm.
Like Ivy League schools, and just from an Ivy League. So call him rather than call somebody from NIU. And that, mm-hmm. I'm not saying that, I'm sure that the person that gets to an Ivy League school is probably better than me, but I'm not saying he's always the most expert person in the world.
Especially when it gets into a very specific area. Everyone.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, even when Amin's mentioning authority can be very narrow, especially in some areas.
Very specific topic.
Well, and when we're talking about something in technology, you can be an authority in one language, but not have any clue about another.
You can publish very good in an Ivy League school, but still don't know how to code, right? You know what I'm saying?
Right,
like, so
exactly,
it doesn't mean that just because you went to an Ivy League or you teach an Ivy League school, you are the expert of everything. And so I think in the past was like that, but now LinkedIn give a voice. I mean, it's social media are giving a voice to people that are in less privileged school, if I can use that term, and the opportunity with the followers to get noticed. And again, I have no interest to go on radio and TV. I'm fine with my little podcast at NIU, but
is not little.
Yes, now we are in a nice
tens of followers.
That's why today we are more excited than usual, because we are all together in our studio for the first time. But
since the pandemic.
So, but that said, I think that aspect of it is true. Now going back, I think we kind of went on a different route from what we want to initially to talk about, which is where do you consume this information? I want to say, if you follow the right people, you really can find a lot. And a lot much faster than before. And I want to hear what Amin is doing on that side of things, but it keeps me updated. I literally, sometimes I'm overwhelmed by too many things. I keep sharing to different groups of students, different opportunities or new releases of packages. It helps me with keeping up with the materials to stay up to date and just, you know, teaching the best of the best. But also, again, so much thing going on. I don't know. I mean, you want to take the original?
I think your approach makes total sense. Following people that know stuff and follow major developments.
Can you give us some context here as well?
Yes.
I mean, why is
context
chuckling?
Context here is how do you keep up with advancements in your field? And in general, other things such as news as well. So, we had lunch before this, and this was a lunch conversation. So Biagio said that's how he keeps up. And then the word got out that I'm not active in social media.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were curious how I get my information. I get it the traditional way. I check outlets.
Mm-hmm.
I check tech websites. I check publications, and I did used to have a newspaper print subscription until last year, but
until
it was
last year, everyone. Yeah. Last year,
saying that,
and I'm considering a new one. So,
And what, I'm not disagreeing with your that makes sense. The way you find information, you follow people instead of outlets. That is, I think, that can give you more information. Actually, mine is not an ideological difference with you. It's just laziness.
No. Yeah, I am
doing less work, and I'm getting less information, but I feel like I'm getting enough. So it's worked fine for me.
But so a couple of things here. I think you will be more efficient in getting the information and you will be more targeted in the information that you are getting. For example, I follow only the journal in which I want to publish or I published or I'm interested or related to my field or potential outlet.
Or is on our list.
Or is on our department list for tenure. You know, I'm only following them and not just any type of thing because it will be too much. It will be overwhelming.
Absolutely.
And same thing with the people I follow and I connect with are mostly our developers that work with POSIT or they are people that are developing packages for R. But of course, some of them are doing R and Python nowadays. So I'm getting twice the information. Yeah. Mm. And it's super good because now I'm keeping up with both of them at the same time by just following, I'll say 10-15 people. 10-15 people do
that's all manageable.
Do all my job in the sense of keeping me updated, other than enrolling the newsletter of this guy and then the other guy and then and so on and so forth.
But it will take me so much time. What you've done is you have spent probably years to narrow down to this 15 people. And then you probably maintain that list. You probably unfollow some and follow new ones.
So
that's the work you do, and they do the rest of it for you, right?
Yeah. I was lucky enough. Again, I had the chance to go to conferences. They were just for people that code. I was certified through them. So I met some of these people. And so for me, it's much easier. And same thing with professor. I met them at conferences, so I know which professor can bring value to whatever they share. Mm-hmm. And journal is much easier because there are journal ranking lists that matter to us. Yeah. But yes, but I'm happy to share those things with my students or people that are interested to get into the data analytics fields. Because again, you don't have to waste time into that. It's actually the people that produce that content on a constant basis. That's what I admire about them. And we have our LinkedIn page for the getaway and I try to run it and there's just not always the time to say, let's dedicate this amount of time, which is now is insane because with AI, I should be able to do it. But I really admire their consistency. Every day they post something. It's a commitment. And again, I'm trying to find balance in my life.
I'm glad you brought that to students.
Yeah.
So our students are way more proficient in social media than we are.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah?
And I heard from Russ a couple of episodes ago. Two episodes ago? I don't know. I don't know if that episode is even out.
About all of them being content creators.
So all of them are aspiring at least to be content creators because why not? And if you start early, I feel really weird hearing my voice now. And then I don't want to see my, video even.
We grew into social media where they have grown up with social media.
I don't know if they have those feelings. If you don't have those, then you won't have a problem just turning it on and say, what's up? I'm going to go do this.
Right.
You know?
And actually, on the student side of things, there is the other element of if you are acting on LinkedIn, you have also higher chances to be noticed by company. LinkedIn is recommending me to respond to this question to show that you are an expert. I don't have time to do that, I don't have no reason to do it. But for a student, I've seen many students engaging in those type of things, being active just to get noticed a little bit more compared to the others.
I don't like that.
The amount
of work someone needs to do now to find a job has grown tenfold.
Yeah.
And it's because of all of this availability of how you can show yourself. And
you're a brand. Well, we even talk about that with your personal brand. When you are looking for jobs, how are you presenting yourself? We teach that is a strategy to to find more opportunity. But yeah, I didn't really even think of
that's
how...
that's just the work of finding work has... So that I'm not an economist, but that cannot be good for market efficiency or whatever. More information is always good, but there is also... Not always good. More information can be good, but it can be too much.
Mm-hmm.
And if everyone does it, you have no choice but to do it.
Which is where we're at now.
I agree with what you're saying, but at the same time, you need to keep up with the pace with the time we are living, right? If before there were so many jobs available, especially for people graduating for our programs, that they were getting a job within a year without no stress, and now you have to fight to get interviews, then you need to find a way to sell yourself. And if social media is your platform where you can get noticed more, do that. I tell my student other things. I tell my student, instead of printing a resume like many people still do, you still have to do it. Yeah. You can build yourself a website and you can create a portfolio of different projects that showcase your skills and your strength. Right? Yeah. You like data visualization, do something, a portfolio of data visualization projects that you've done on different data sets across different industries. Pick an industry that you really like. That's way to get noticed. It's extra work. I agree with you, but in the end of the day, once you build this stuff, show, right? You have something to show. It's like for us, why do we need publication? The publication is a measure of our productivity on a research side of things.
Yeah.
Now, is more work than before getting published, right? Some of the requirements.
Well, it goes to the same thing you guys are going through. Because when you're applying to journal, and I'm going to show my complete ignorance here, but is there a application similar to a job application? Well, the submission, but you don't just get to submit your paper. Right. Like, so there's still a relatively similar experience of applying for a job. I'm stretching the metaphor, but screening too.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you have to do all that work.
And review, which you could say review is the interview.
Right.
And it could be rejected before review.
Right. Yeah. But so how much work do you have to do on, not even once you're rejected or in review? I say that's once you've already they're interested in talking to you. Any of my students, any students out there, any people, once they get to at least some type of that next step, a lot of times I'm like, that's all you can hope for when you're applying for a job. That's a great success, whether you get it or not. Good job. How much time do you all spend on just the legwork to be able to be considered for something?
I don't know which part you're asking. So writing the paper is most of the work.
Yeah, that's correct. I'm meaning from when you have your paper, you're submitting it for consideration.
Yeah.
The just
formatting will change across different journals. Cover letter, they ask kind of highlight. They ask this different thing when you do a submission, but I don't think
those things
are
that are very similar to a lot of them that you're like, because I think that's why a lot of people are frustrated with the work or applying the work to get work is I'm writing my same high school, my same education, my address, all of my jobs onto this application. Then they want the resume again. And I have to do that every single time. And I have to set up a new portal and a new account with every single company I go from. And that's taking
literally.
And
then I have to have an online persona too.
Correct.
Then because everyone has
what Biagio is saying.
But what you're saying makes sense. It might be because times are tough.
Yeah.
If times are
easier, then
people might not do much of it as much.
I honestly, on the research side, just to clarify, what I was going with is that, for example, I'm taking MIS Quarterly, which is one of the top journals in our field, right? Mm-hmm. So 20 years ago, there were N person in the field, right? With N person now is multiplied by 30, and it's still a quarterly journal.
Right.
Right?
Oh, I see.
So,
so it's
the
just
competition
the content
to get there,
yeah,
the review timing, everything is increasing, but the requirements from school for us to get tenure, I can only imagine R1 school is even more stressed than ever before.
Yes.
So I'm just saying it was much easier for somebody to get those requirements 30 years ago than it is now, right? Yeah. Just because it was such a small group of researcher, and now
you're almost kind of saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm going to extrapolate here, so I'm not speaking for Biagio or Amin or anything with this one, but I'm meaning at some point then the research might not have been as rigorous.
Yeah.
Because there's less people doing it, so you're kind of like, all right, I'm going to take what we can get because it's quarterly, where now you have 30 times more, so you're getting probably better results, but then again, how much is being missed, too?
How much is being missed? You're assuming everything is evaluated equally. No, they're not evaluated equally.
That's right.
When papers come in, they don't review. They reject most of them before review in these journals like MISQ and ISR and the top ones.
What does that process? What does normally a rejection before?
Is a desk rejection. It's like the editor in chief just look at the paper and there is no fee.
Is there any
quality
information on like what that
they
is?
Write
like,
to you why.
Okay, but I'm meaning like so when people apply for jobs, a lot of times you'll hear at least from a federal level, like most HR professionals will spend 15 to 30 seconds reviewing a resume. Is there anything just as a like a general context of like
so we have information about how long a journal takes from submission to decision, first decision,
first decision.
And that's usually short if you look at the average, but it's misleading because most of them are rejected in a couple of weeks because they don't go to review. What matters is if it goes to review, what percentage goes to review, and if it goes to review, how long it takes for the first decision after review, it goes to review. But the problem with that is editors and everyone, these are humans. Mm-hmm. And if they have past work that they have done themselves, they are going to be more interested in topics that come in that way. And then that's why journals now have like 50 associate editors.
Because they need to cover so many.
Cover so many. And also
just
they're
from
receiving
human
like
biases.
Volumes of submissions. Mm. And then after that, they have to turn around and find reviewers for this so many submissions that they have received. And those are going to be the same people that submitted, the same pool. It's in the same pool.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You need three reviewers for one submission.
So actually,
it's a problem.
So actually, this is going to sound funny and like we planned this. But one other reason why I like to follow Jason is because he talks about this stuff. So I've never been an editor in chief or any big managerial role on that side of things, right? I have conference experience being associate editor, and now I have my first journal associate editor experience coming up.
Congratulations.
Yeah, but other than that, I didn't see the system, and knowing how the system works, it's very important because you also can understand what's going behind the scene.
Right.
Because it's very easy for an editor to just complain, hey, it's been 3 months, where is my output? And then sometimes you know that the struggle is the reviewer is behind, or it first accepted and then he say he couldn't do it no more. And so there is so much going on behind that because one of the problems actually Jason is talking about is that the whole system is built on us doing work for free for the publishers.
Yeah, right.
The publishers makes money out of us, makes money out of our ideas and our papers and knowledge
and
that
the
we
labor.
Disseminate through them. And we write those papers for free for them, right? Just to get
we do
their publication.
Editorial process, we do review process, we do
exactly.
All of it.
And all of that is not paid. And you know, it's factoring
in. They pay typesetters.
Yeah, it's factoring as service, like the reviewer part of it. So we get some recognition on that side of things, but no economical benefits,
right?
And that the writing of the paper is factoring the research side of things, right? So it's actually if we invite him, I'm inviting him after this episode.
Please.
I want to see where is it going, because I think what I'm feeling, what I'm reading from his post is that that system is really getting broke. And you were saying like there was less rigor in the past and, you know, methodologically especially, there was less people able to check some of those papers than being published. I think it was less of a game. I think now because everybody needs to get tenure, a lot of people are looking at the small contribution. They just get into a paper just because they know that's the system and that's how they play the system, which is super sad.
Yeah.
Because I actually don't even start a project where I don't see a big impact, which is very naive of me. And, you know, it's not what they recommend to a tenure track. But I like to do work that has an impact to beyond
which
academia.
Which is why we have this system. Yeah. A lot of it was, we want you making an academic and a benefit to society with your research, and we want as an institution to have you a part
but
of our
community.
But
now it's a lottery. Now it's a lottery. That's why I'm saying, like, was he describing some of those desk reject? Like, I got a few of them recently, and when I read the reason for the desk reject, I'm literally thinking, did they read the paper?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and by read the paper doesn't mean scrolling it for 5 minutes, which I get it. Like, sometimes they get so many submissions, they have to do it to get fast feedback. But if maybe I'm not the best writer, I'm not even an English speaker, so you guys can tell maybe sometimes I'm not conveying the things in the right way. But some of the comments are like, you didn't read the paper. Right?
Yeah.
And you didn't read the paper.
I've had reviewer, not just desk rejection. I've had papers that go to review. We recently had a rejection after revision. And the reviewer said, you haven't said this information is not provided, that information is not provided. And I'm looking at my paper. It's there. Mm-hmm. You see, so this because it's just there's too many. And people are not like.
But then the system is broke, right?
Yeah,
because people are risking their career. You're not gonna get tenure if you don't get an publication in certain outlets.
So those
requirements should change because the time has changed. I think that's what he's going with it. But again, I want to talk to him or somebody that is in the editorial board, and I don't want to do claim that I might be wrong. But I think that's the expectation and the stress that is put on people that might have a wife and kids or want to live a life as well.
Yeah.
Given the current times, given the reviewing time is increasing, given that to publish in those top journals is much harder than before, I think, again, we are completely off topic to what we started with.
This is very good because I have more questions.
I honestly think that some changes needs to be done. And to keep the integrity of those journals, to keep the quality of the journal. Again, I think other than the few top journal, everything else is becoming a game. And that's super scary. And that's like where you don't want to be, because I already feel that sometimes practitioners don't take us serious because our research is like 3 years old compared to what the world is now.
Yeah, because it took
takes us three years to publish it, right? Yeah. And there are practitioner-oriented outlets like MSQE and other journal that they make you do that type of impact, and maybe it's not about the theory that you're developing and stuff like that. But at the same time, I feel like we are making ourselves, we are digging our own hole. And I'm just a junior faculty, so we want to bring somebody more expert. Yeah. But I do see that way. And I mean, taking 2 years to publish in some journals makes sense. And if it is like a top journal for your career, but in other journals, it
needs to be different.
And then they reject you a third round and you have to start from the beginning. So it's not 2 years, it's four years. And then it's really an old idea. Nobody's going to read that and it's not going to have any impact.
Yeah. I mean, what I was trying to say is, it's just the volume. It's the volume of material that is being submitted. I decline review requests if I don't have a full day to give to that review.
And that's very little.
That's very little. That's what I'm trying to say. Because I heard when I was a PhD student, I heard from my PhD mentor that, you will get review requests when you are a researcher that is, you know, published and stuff, and people can find you online. And you should spend like several days and like probably a week and write like 5 pages of review. And I don't. I spend one day and I write 1 or 2 pages of review because that's all I can do. If I'm waiting for a time where I will have 3 days, I will never review anything.
Right. Well, during the semester is different. But
I can see a lot of people, a lot of reviewers, even responding to my reviews, my papers, that it seems like they spent even less than a day, probably an hour, a couple of hours.
That's
reading the paper.
Yeah, what is the solution?
And this is the point, right? We're doing it for free, and we get some point in service. And so
there are issues with paid reviewers too. There are serious issues. There are serious issues with paid authors. There are serious issues with paid publishing.
No, but
pay to publish.
I'm not saying that you need to be paid, but there has to be a better way. Like, so I give more than one day when I do the review, and I only accept if I have the time to do it seriously, because the people are putting years of effort into a paper, and then you don't even read their paper, is so bad. But I'm getting the invite of reviewing in journal that I never submitted. And again,
because they just need someone.
There is a rule, like if you submit a journal, a paper to a conference, there are non-written rules. Like if you submit a journal to a conference, you should submit a review at least three papers. That's kind of like what is the unwritten rule in the IS world, right? Mm-hmm. In the IS world. But reviews on top of reviews from journal that you never submitted, right? And then it becomes, again, do I have the time to do a good job? I don't want to just say yes because it gives me point for my service. I want to say yes if, first of all, I understand that topic very well. And sometimes there is no fit. I don't understand why they send me those reviews. I should read so much literature to even understand what they are trying to do. And they want it in 28 days, which to me is a lot, because if I need to read literature, I'm not going to get there. And I have to do my own research.
And
I have to teach in a 3-2 school, right? So there is, and I have a family, and
three
I want to live a life.
Teaching load.
Teaching load. Sorry, yes.
Three classes.
So it's not R1, you know, highly research-oriented school. So where is my time going to go?
And which is also interesting. And again, I'm completely ignorant. I'm not a faculty. I'm very, I admire anyone going into that stuff. But one of the other things then is you also compete on the same field, metaphorically, R1 institutions as well. So I'm not saying that
because
it should be different.
Correct.
Exactly. You're a research school. You should be. We all are advancing knowledge, but you're going up against people that may only be teaching one class or a PhD class with one student, and they're like, here's my teaching load. You know,
teach less, more resources, opportunity to go present their paper. Like
it's like when NIU goes up against Notre Dame. You know, like we gotta. But for real, we're on the same field, but it's a different
same journals. We target the same journals,
right?
That's why.
As you should.
But the expectations are different. The expectations are different.
That's
I want to clarify that.
But it still has to be. You still are competing on those same ones.
When you want to publish that, absolutely.
Right. And they don't hold you to different. They're not like, oh, okay, here's our expectations because you're on an R2, R3. They hold you to those same qualities.
They will need, like, I don't know, 4 MSQ or ISR, and they need one of them to go a full professor. Maybe.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
But when you nail it, you beat the team. You did the thing at that exact same level, which is awesome. I'm...
And a lot of people do in NIU.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yes, please. And and also, just to kind of, I know I kind of joke around in here, but I am very, like, the people that are doing this work, it's a very difficult job, both as professors, as editors. There is no right answer to this because when we're talking about, well, let's pay these editors, we're like, that gets to be a problem, right? Like, where does this go? But it comes back to a larger issue within a lot of our society is you can look at almost every industry and see our volume is impacting the quality of whatever that is, whether it's healthcare, whether it's technology, whether it's academics, education. We just have so much, and it feels like it's getting to be overwhelming in so many different areas where we joke about going negative with some of like the technology things, but it's very real when you look past that first layer. You're like, oh, there's some serious issues.
Which makes me curious. Why? Why do we have so much more scientific submissions than before? What happened?
It's more global. IS, for example, was born in the US. Like if you were going to University of Minnesota, that's where the first PhD program in IS was. And that's where MISQ is hosted.
Yeah,
right?
Shout out to PJ Fleck, coach of the Gophers, NIU grad.
Shout out to all the Minnesota, Minnesota is the reference, right? That's where I think that's all it started. I don't want to say, don't quote me on that, because I did it during my PhD seminar and I got old. But then, is honestly one of the first, right? If it's not the first, it's one of the first. You
but
were
now,
going there. And there were very few
schools. They have information systems in
Asia.
In Asia.
So it's a good thing. It's becoming a global field, but there are way more people in it, and it's getting more competitive because across the globe there are different requirements as well. Like for example, in Germany, if you publish in ICIS, which is our major conference, right, is worth like a journal publication. So when you go to ICIS, all the German PhD student, they send a lot of paper.
Yeah,
and it becomes very hard. I think Germany has more submission than US in a few ICS, recent ICS. And the US has more scholar, like not comparable, but because of the incentive of publishing the top.
It's been incentivized.
That's what I'm saying. So it's more people, still quarterly journal though. So they still get the same amount of paper. Yeah. You have more special issue whatsoever. Yeah, I'm not saying it's exactly the same thing as before, but it's not keeping up with the number. Yeah, it's not keeping up with the number.
But I want to also tell any students that are listening to this, research is very rewarding. I know that nothing you do is going to be not challenging. Everything is challenging, and these are the challenges of doing research. And research is incredibly rewarding, especially if you are free to do what you want, which is what a professor gets. It's a sweet deal. It's the best job in life.
But are you free that you are in the tenure track? Do you feel free?
I feel somewhat free.
Yeah. If you are lucky, if you have a good pipeline coming out of a PhD with a few already publication in line, I think you're free, but majority in reality is a lot of people are not free.
Yeah, they're not free, but
in the sense that they need to get the numbers.
Yeah, once you get the numbers, then you're free.
But it's 6 years. That feeling. It takes 6 years to get the number for
but
some people.
But after that, I think being a professor is the best job.
Yeah.
Because you get to say what you want in class. And you get to do what you want with your research.
I mean, it's
within your field.
I know.
You know what I mean. Within reason.
No. I want to say this. This is a call to all the students that want to dive more into the research side of things, because I think the perception of a student is that the professor goes to class and say what he wants. I think it's very, is very true, but it's really not like that. We are forced. And sometimes my student ask me that, right? My student ask me, why you are not teaching this or why are you not teaching that? Well, there are some stuff decided at the university to make those changes takes forever.
Yeah.
And they don't know that.
You have
to
teach the course. I'm saying you can say you're an expert. You can give expert opinion.
But at the same time, I can teach the same course in so many different ways.
Yeah.
But I want to teach it in a way that is relevant for them. The skills that I want to give them are skills that are used.
You make that choice.
I made that choice.
Exactly.
Everybody does that. But what I'm saying is on the research side, there are so many projects that we do that are very applied. They can like make them experience. I have a few students right now. I'm telling them like, you love to learn, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Why don't you consider a PhD?
Mm.
You know what I'm saying? Like when you love to learn, that gives you the time to learn more, to improve your skills, to get also
that's what I mean by rewarding.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Is this techno music in the background?
There is static.
As you're looking at these different opportunities within research, within everything that you're doing, and we're talking about maybe having some of it missed just because of the pure volume out there, what happens to a paper or something that you all have put significant research into? Nothing comes from it.
You submit somewhere else.
But then let me say this. Is there a point where that is not accepted, but you still had a, like it's still a paper. Like you
I know,
still
that's
did
a very
research.
Sad situation, but it's rare. Every paper has a home.
I actually.
You're like a BuzzFeed over here.
Yeah, no.
Somewhere.
Oh, actually, that's super funny. I think the last post I read of Jason was about this.
Really?
And he was saying,
Jason
was talking about quitting early. It's not worth the time. If you write two outlets and every outlet is going to give you some reviews, right? Mm-hmm. So you try to make those changes.
Then you go to the
next one.
You do exactly
so you keep running across different journal and different review and make them happy, and then they reject, then you are restarting from scratch. And after that, it's 6 years.
Right.
And that, what he's saying is quit early. Meaning that when you see this is not succeeding, I think he didn't say that, but I think if you are two rejection in, I think it's time to move on. And true what he says, it has an outlet.
Just send it somewhere. You don't work on it then.
But
it's
such a lottery right now though that you might go to a different journal. I can disclose this. I think everybody has this as a plan. When you start a project, you try to do a high quality work.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, sometimes you do high quality work, rigorous work, but the results are not there to go to a top journal.
Because it's just not groundbreaking. It just, it's just the hypothesis
that you had were groundbreaking, but they are rejected, for example.
Understand.
But it's still a solid work, and it's still like, there is still some contribution, but it's just not theoretical contribution enough to go to a top journal or anywhere close. But the idea was you target an A journal usually, and then it's not good enough, you're going to go lower. Mm-hmm. Or if you target an A journal, you submit there, you get rejected, you start going B and C and so on and so forth, right? Usually don't go below C. But I think the point is, you can waste so much time in even within B to go to another B, because first round of review or the first journal, they give you some adjustment. You make those adjustments, you come back, they reject you, right? You last 1 year plus all the changes to the original journal. So it's a new journal. The reviewer, they don't realize that, but sometimes they completely change the paper.
Yeah.
What they request sometimes is completely unreasonable.
Yeah.
Which again is like, it will be another study. But you have to do it because at that point you are 1 year in. So if you keep chasing, I think in the end, sometimes you can waste like 5 years of your time and then ended up in a C journal.
But you're submitting and waiting. So you just, if the changes are big, you make them once. But don't do big revisions more than, like, if you don't think it has a future in that journal. Don't get into, like, if they tell you to rewrite the paper, sometimes they do.
But then it's an old journal. You still need to update the literature.
Yeah.
Because, it's not really just resubmit to another journal. You need, like, in 1 year, there's going to be study that done something similar to yours. So you need to still see.
Then that's it's complicated. Dead, yes. If your paper eventually becomes irrelevant, then you're dead.
So I think he's right. Like, quit early. And again, we can ask him what he means. How early do you need to quit? But I think if you get two of that, I have one paper like that. I have one paper like that. We try. This is the third journal.
I've given up on one paper too.
This is the third journal we are in. And each one of them, we pass the first round. And then the second round, they say no. And then this one passed the first round. Now second round, major revisions. Mm. My co-author is putting majority of the work and he's doing it. I was like, I'm not sure. I think we should.
I see.
I call it a quit. But he's doing, no, I'm willing to do it. For me, it's very important. And I was like, okay, I'll help you out as much as I can. But it's such a burden. And that's what I'm talking about. If we had just different reviewers, the same paper could have been published as
exactly.
It is.
Exactly. It's
literally
a
lottery. Yeah. So it's sad because of that.
Well, this was, I found to be very interesting, and I think a lot of our listeners will. Can you, Biagio, give us Jason's actual last name?
Jason Thatcher, 48,333 followers.
Affiliation.
Affiliation, University of Colorado, Boulder.
Okay. Perfect. Boulder, Colorado.
So the lesson from this episode, we invite Jason.
Invite Jason. Everybody will benefit from our conversation.
If anyone can reach out to Jason as well, because we might not have
We can ask Rafaele. Rafaele is our friend.
Kishen, who was in Boulder.
That's right.
It's the same department.
And I'm also just telling our students to start adding him on LinkedIn. And come to the gateway with us.
One thing we can do for our student after we digress a lot on academia is, first of all, I have a provocative message. It's like, are we all switching to Blue Sky? Yes or no, I saw some images and the some video and it feels a lot like Twitter, so maybe it might be back in
a different outlet. FYI, Tailgate Prophet, if you want to find me there, I am on there. So, I think you can come on there. I think we'll
you're already on the Blue Sky bus then.
If you are not
and you are in the data analytics world, we can put a link to this episode, which has data starter packs. So you can, you know, you are a Python guy. You follow only the Python, whatever you, I'm not forcing anybody into what I'm following, but I think those starter pack will give you guys access to people that are well known, established in the community of coders, programmers, and data science, data analytics. That's what I follow. And that's how I get all the content and they bring to your classes most of the time. I'm not saying I'm using their content. I'm just saying. A new package is released, I check it out, and I see if that's the best way to approach it, because there are so many libraries and not each one of them is bringing the same value or is easy the same way for the student. And in the end, it comes out to stay up to pace. So, for example, I don't teach anymore base R, I teach Tidyverse. And if I didn't follow these people, I didn't know what it is because I started with base R.
Perfect. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for your time. For everyone listening, if you want to come see a newspaper in print, you can find Amin at his office hours. He might still have a newspaper around there. This is a legendary.
Charles and I. That's where he's finding all the information.
Yeah, I love the smell.
I also want to send out a shout out to the 71 North Partnership Studio here on Northern Illinois University's campus. They have a wonderful podcast studio, and they're allowing us
for
to
the first time. Yeah,
exactly.
For the first time,
we are grateful for them. So.
Yes,
that's why we are more excited, I guess.
Exactly right. Yeah. Exactly.
Laughing a little bit more than.
And if any of our students are looking around, make sure to swing by the Innovation Studio right underneath the library, the basement of the library. It has great resources and a lot of ways to get involved. So make
Taco
sure
Taco Tuesday
to,
as well.
Like Taco Tuesday
for
Tech
for all
Taco
tacos.
Tuesday. Tech Taco Tuesday. Yes.
Tech Tacos.
Tech Tacos.
Yes. Thank you guys. Have a great rest of your week.
And thank you for listening to another episode of The Gateway, brought to you by Northern Illinois University, where your future is our focus. And please, remember to love always the promise of tomorrow today.